Subway everyday value means many mouth-watering piled high favorites are $5 footlongs, like the fresh-toasted tempting meatball marinara. And made-to-your-order BLT, the $5 footlong anthem rolls on only at Subway, where great everyday value lives. Subway, eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, we've wanted to have this guy on for a while, and now he's here, my ESPN colleague, Disney colleague, ABC colleague. He's a colleague. He's also part of the best three-man basketball announcing booth of all time, in my opinion, and he's on the Subway Fresh Take hotline right now, Mr. Jeff Van Gundy. Are you excited? This is a big game, big group of game fives tonight. Holy mackerel.
It is. I was so upset after the Celtics win. I took your dog on a long walk. Wow. That's heartbreaking for Orlando.
Hey, come on. But secretly, you're kind of rooting against your brother because you want mom's approval.
And you No, believe me. I've gotten enough of mom, her suggestions over the years. I just want him to win.
Yeah.
Jeez. Yes.
I'll tell you, that was a tough one. When you defend a play perfectly and it goes to the third option, a guy who was the third string power forward on the Boston Celtics in December, and he drains a 20-footer, that's a tough way to lose. In fact, I would argue that there's no tougher way, maybe.
Well, and I think, you know, what people aren't giving Glenn Davis credit for is the shot he made on the previous possession.
Mm.
Off the dribble, going to his left, to me, that was a big, big-time shot. And I think it also speaks, you know, to the Celtics' depth and their resilience.
Yeah.
You think about the people on their front line today versus last year. Scalabrine and Glenn Davis weren't even in the rotation, and Scalabrine wasn't even on the active roster. And so I give those guys a lot of credit for the perseverance they've shown.
And by the way, that was the case in even December. Scalabrine was wearing street clothes, and Glenn Davis was the 11th or 12th man, depending on the game. I agree. I think, you know, whatever. People are not going to like the Celtics. People don't like KG. They're going to root for whoever the newcomer is. But if you like sports at all, you got to appreciate a team that is defending the title. You know, that's your job. You win the title, you wear the championship belts, and you defend it until somebody knocks you out. And this Celtics team has defended the title, I think, with about as much resilience as any champ that we've seen in a long time.
Well, you have to give them that credit, and they've done it in a very proud way.
Yeah.
Now, maybe they don't like Garnett yelling from the bench. Who cares?
Right.
Really, who cares about that? All I know is, compared to most champions in previous years, they've come to play seemingly every night. And for a championship team, who most teams come off a little bit of a hangover, for them to win 19 games in a row before Christmas, you got to give the players credit, the coaching staff credit, management, ownership, all of them deserve a lot of credit for how much they put into each and every game, each and every night.
Yeah, because anyone can win the title once. But once you got the bullseye on you, and you come back, and you've already done it, and you got guys complaining about, all right, I need more playing time now, we already won, or I need to make more money, and to fight through all that stuff and just say, we're going to show up every night. Give us your best shot. We're the champs. We think we can beat you. You don't see it that much in basketball anymore. For instance, I remember the 2001 Lakers, the year after they won the first time. Remember like how screwed up their next season was and all the crap that happened?
Biggest example, I think, Bill, is the Miami team.
Yeah.
I mean, they get beat by, 44 on opening night the next year?
Yeah.
Can you imagine this Celtic team getting beat by 44 at home? I mean,
no.
I couldn't even fathom them getting beat, let alone getting down and then staying down. And to me, they have a lesser roster this year, and they've had to deal with many more injuries this year. Lesser people would have just given in at some point during the season, and that's why I think this season, it's not going to result in a championship, I don't believe, but this season they can be just as proud of what they've accomplished as what happened last year when they won the whole thing.
Totally agree. And, you know, the other part you didn't mention was they put a lot of miles on their legs last year, 108 games. I think especially you've seen Paul Pierce. I'm getting emails from Boston like, Paul Pierce, what's wrong with him? It's like, well, here's what's wrong with him. He's played almost 200 games in 19 months, and he's been carrying this offense and guarding the other team's best scorer a lot of times and playing 40 minutes a game and rebounding and doing all the things he does. And at his, when you get over 30 and you're doing that, it's just, I just think it's hard to keep that pace.
Right, and he's not that natural athlete, you know, where he's going to beat you with blinding speed. So, to me, a loss of a quarter step here, whether it's to fatigue or injury or age, it doesn't matter. It's going to impact him maybe as much as anybody. And yet, you know, to me, when I hear him speak and I watch him play, you know, people aren't giving him the credit for, you know, just two or three years ago, he wasn't even close to like this. You know, he's a champion now. Whether they win the championship this year or not, he's a champion in how he's gone about his job this year.
Yeah.
And like I said, sometimes I think we get too caught up in, you know, did a certain guy win a championship in a particular year? That makes him a champion or not. No, Paul Pierce has conducted himself as a champion this year, whether they win it or not.
Yeah, and as someone who's followed him for his entire career and went to basically his first three seasons of home games, it's been kind of rewarding to watch him mature into what he's become. And I think this is something that we see so often in the NBA, where you have a guy who has the high pedigree, and it just takes them a while to put it together. And the ironic thing is that teams will give up on these guys over and over again, try to trade them. Maybe they bounce around three, four times. Look at Chauncey Billups. What is he on, his sixth team?
Right.
And it's one of those things, the lack of patience with these guys just kind of waiting for them to mature into what they're eventually going to become, I think is what's killed a lot of these NBA teams.
Well, and it's also underestimating who you're playing with, who you're playing for, and what management is in place. Because it all goes together. It's not just incumbent on the player to be good. You've got to be surrounded by the right type of players who complement your skills with the right attitudes, being coached by the right guy, and having a general manager who understands that his job is not about acquiring talent. It's about putting together a team.
Right.
And all those factors have to be in place for a star player to ascend to what, you know, people want him to become.
Yeah, and I just finished this NBA book, and one of the chapters is about, is there a perfect way to put a team together? And I think the best blueprint that we've seen has been what San Antonio did during the Popovich-Duncan era and what the Celtics did last year. And basically it's you find your three foundation guys, and then you surround them with role players who know their place and who are perfectly willing to sublimate whatever they need to sublimate to make everybody else better. Have you, you know, you coached for a lot of years. Did you ever coach a team that you feel like got the closest to that, you know, that dream scenario?
Well, I thought when I was in New York in 97, mm-hmm. I think my first full year, we had Ewing at still a really high level. We had Starks, who was still, you know, good, and we had Allen Houston, who was on the rise. And then we had some, you know, Larry Johnson was still pretty good, even though he was hobbled by back, and Oakley. And so we had a persona. We had enough depth, and, you know, we played in the time where the rules fit our team.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was the best. And I think in my Houston years, I had two, you know, really good players. Like you said, probably we needed a better third player.
Yeah.
And those McGrady and Yao were, you know, they traded off with injury, so it made it hard, you know, to ever get, you know, a higher seed to get you, you know, to a better spot. But and that's a function of management, is trying to put all those factors together and having the patience and realizing, Bill, that sometimes once you win it, you're going to have to change those role players around because, like you said previously, they're going to want more shots, more money, more time, and you may have to go out and change the role players. But once you have those three key core foundation pieces with the right character, the right skills, and the complementary skills, you can be set for a decade.
That 97 Knicks team you coached, wasn't that the team that you basically got screwed over by the leaving the bench thing?
Right. That was, you know, and this brings me really to this, you know, this year's stuff. The problem I have with all the suspensions, it's almost like as a league we're taking pride in that we suspend players.
Yeah.
And the problem I have is mandatory sentencing doesn't work in our criminal courts, and it doesn't work in the NBA. So Amari Stoudemire, Bill, gets a game a couple years ago in a crucial series against San Antonio for taking a step on the court. That's one game. Rafer Alston gets a game this year for love tapping Eddie House on the back of the head. And then Derek Fisher gets one game for bowling a guy over with premeditated thought of running through him. The same sentence for far different infractions. I really don't understand it. I didn't understand it back in 97, and I don't understand it in 2009.
Yeah, and you know, the difference between the NBA and the real world is that there can be interpretation. It's a sports league. Ultimately, the commissioner can step in and decide what he wants to decide. And, the 97 Knicks thing, that's a whole other issue. But even the Amari thing, this guy just watched his best player get thrown in the scorer's table, basically. Your natural reaction as a teammate is going to be to run toward him.
And what's wrong with that? We teach and preach loyalty and having each other's back, and somehow we have confused discipline with the illusion of discipline. And, you know, him taking a step towards the court without instigating anything, that's why we're paying, you know, Stu Jackson. He's there to make those decisions. He doesn't need, Stu Jackson's a bright man. He doesn't need, you know, that a step on the court is one game. He can decide. And I would tell you this, too. I think it's about time that we start giving them more flexibility, not only with the sentencing that they give, but why does it have to be zero games or one game? Why can't it be 6 minutes?
Oh, I like it. I like that.
18 minutes.
Yeah.
Now we have more flexibility, almost like a penalty box. So to me, it gives you more flexibility to give out fair, equitable discipline versus lumping jaywalkers with armed robbers, which is what we're doing right now and giving everybody one game.
Jeff Van Gundy, you're a genius. I like this idea. A penalty box. We'll put it courtside. We'll have it sponsored by Best Buy.
It'll pay for itself. Right?
And then,
It'll pay for itself.
Yeah. So for instance, Rafer Alston hits Eddie House in the back of the head. He's out for the first quarter.
Or just say this. Or give him a game, not for the hit on the head. Say, you know what? That was utterly stupid.
Yeah.
A game for stupidity. I have no problem with that. But not for a little love tap like that. I mean, that's, you know, and I'm not saying old school or new school, because safety is, you know, has to be an issue. And I understand the league has to, you know, be the bad guy and make sure everybody's safe. But I think we've just gone overboard on suspensions, flagrants, technicals. And I would say this. Why also on a flagrant foul or when another guy gets a technical foul, do we have to go to the free throw line and make it? If you get hit upside your head and you're woozy, now you have to go to the free throw line and make the free throws? Just give the guy the 2 points.
That's interesting. Yeah. It goes back to the bigger problem, which is this is a game that's physical. It's a game that we've all played, and you're going to bounce into somebody else's body. You're going to take an elbow from time to time. Somebody's going to accidentally bump you. You might accidentally clang heads. You might get mad at somebody. You might yell at somebody. But ultimately, it's not personal. And, you know, I think that's what we've been missing here with all the way these rules have changed, that Carmelo Anthony last night, he didn't want to punch Antoine Wright. He just wanted the guy to let him go, and he's mad, and he's in there playing basketball. And if he had even grazed him with that open-fisted hit or whatever it was, he's suspended tonight or for tomorrow night.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, that's a normal human reaction where a guy's clamping on his arm and won't let go.
Yeah.
He won't let go. So if you're trying to wriggle free and now you graze his head, that's a suspension?
I mean...
And I know he's a friend of yours. Daryl Morey gave me the best line of all time.
Right.
Which is, every organization needs a vice president of common sense.
That's me.
Is that you?
Yeah, I'm me. I'm the original VP of Common Sense.
Every time I see something like that, and there's some ridiculous result in any sports league, I always think about having that, you know, this person, not even associated with the league, that you call up and say, hey, I want you to look at this play right here. Carmelo Anthony's being held. His arm came free. He grazed the guy's head. We're going to suspend him. What game? One game. And I want that guy to say, for what? You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think sometimes we're so bogged down with trying to appear like we have this discipline that we're not as concerned with actually having discipline.
I couldn't agree more. And you know who's to blame? Ultimately?
No.
You and Pat Riley. I'm sorry. No,
why?
It's really like this. All the blood of this postseason is on your hands and on Pat Riley's hands. I'm sorry to tell you that.
No.
Because you guys, listen. You thugged it up. You thugged it up in the early 90s. You thugged it up in the mid-90s. The NBA overreacted, and now we're here.
Oh, come on now. Listen, those were beautiful teams to watch. Mason, Oakley, Ewing,
yeah.
Starks.
Ballet players.
That was beautiful basketball. All I know is, do you remember the hit Starks put on Scottie Pippen?
I mean,
that would be a lifetime ban now.
It's remember in I think the 91 Game 4 Bulls Pistons, Rodman just levels Pippen from behind, shoves him into the basket support 100 miles an hour. Pippen gets cut like he could have broken his neck.
Right.
He's probably out for 50 games if that happens now.
No question.
Yeah.
And you know what? On those plays, I say rightfully so.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of how Pippen evolved as a player and became more respected is once he started to respond better to people trying to punk him. And it almost like, you know, when he was able to, along with the Chicago Bulls team, you know, withstand the tactics of the Bad Boys, you know, the respect that they had for Pippen, for the Bulls, and for each other grew immensely. So,
well, you guys unleashed, in 92, you guys unleashed the X-Man like he was Luca Brasi. You just unleashed him on Pippen.
Listen.
You tried to psych him out the whole series.
No,
he's mugging,
too.
He's pushing him.
That was like, we would have never thought going into that series, A, that we could get it to seven games. But the reason we got it to seven games was McDaniel dominated that position.
Yeah.
Until Jordan stood up for Pippen.
Yep.
In game seven early. It was like, you know, if you're not going to stand up for yourself, I'm standing up for you. And it was impressive.
I got to say that the 92 Knicks Bulls, and you know, because I was working on this book, I was able to get, I had some of them taped and the NBA sent me some of their DVDs. That is, to me, what basketball is all about. You know, maybe the Knicks went a little overboard with some of the stuff they did, but those were so competitive. And you know, you watch like the end of the Charles Smith game, which I know is a little sore subject for you, but the fact that the Bulls, when you look at how competitive they were on that last play, and all these guys just going up and blocking them, and to me, that's what basketball is about. And now I just feel like everybody's kind of has that hanging over their head. Oh, I don't want to hit this guy. Oh, I we can't do this. And I don't know. I don't like the direction we're going.
Now. Think about it. You know,
what?
Nowadays you'd have to be worried that, you know, like, you know, Jordan and those guys used to always come from behind.
Yeah.
And swipe at it, well, full force trying to block the shot from behind.
Yeah.
If you miss now on a play like that, that's a flagrant too. You know, and again, to me, and somebody made the point last night, I think what we've done at times is we started to confuse good, solid, physical play and dirty play. And I think most people know the difference. You know, how do you know? You watch. You look. So to me, all the terminology about excessive and wind-up, impact, follow-through, no. You know if something's like Rondo, that was, to me, against Brad Miller, I thought it was correctly called a foul, not a flagrant foul. I don't think there was any intent. Other plays, you know what plays are dirty. Like when he slings Heinrich into the stanchion, hey, you want to give him a technical foul on that? I have no problem. You want to give him a flagrant foul on that? I have no problem. But I think we started to confuse and blur the line between hard-nosed, competitive play, which I think fans want to see. I don't think they want to see everybody getting along, helping each other up.
No.
I think they want to see two heavyweights going at it toe-to-toe, and at the end of the series, be very respectful like they do in hockey. But in between, they want to see it all-out competitive battle.
Well, that, and that's what really bugs me about the way this Kobe Artest thing is being approached by everybody. Like, these guys actually like each other. They're just competitive. I think Kobe likes having Ron Artest in the league, likes the challenge that he gives them. I think they like doing all their chirping. It's not a case where they hate each other and they're going to fight after the game. It's part of just their competitiveness and their rivalry. And meanwhile, Artest has now been thrown out of two of the first three games because the refs are so worried about it escalating. It's not going to escalate. These guys like each other. They just like competing.
And what's wrong with, you know, like, all great players want to be challenged.
Yeah.
They do. They don't want it to be easy. They know that the hardest thing in the world, the hardest things in the world to get are things you can't buy. And so to win a ring and a trophy and a championship, you're going to have to go through, most times, a tough road. And for Kobe Bryant, it's Shane Battier hanging on him and then Artest on him. And, you know, Kobe's elbow against Artest, to me, was nothing.
Yeah.
Artest's response to him, hey, you want to give him a technical foul? Fine. No way did he deserve to be thrown out. And then I know they downgraded it from a flagrant 2 in Game 4 to or Game 3 from a flagrant 2 against Artest to a flagrant 1. That wasn't even a flagrant foul. And, you know, for that guy to be thrown out of two games, and in the public's eye, because most people don't know the difference, it's just further tarnishing his reputation. And in those cases, he didn't deserve it. And it's wrong, and I feel badly for him.
You know what's interesting? You were at the game that I think was the real tipping point. Everybody says it was the Kermit Washington punch, but really that didn't change that much. The JoJo English-Derek Harper fight, because Stern was in the stands and it spilled into that first row and it was kind of chaotic. I think from that point on, things changed.
Well, that
it was kind of scary.
Well, and it was foolish on, and Derek Harper was one of the nastiest competitors I've ever had the pleasure of coaching. That guy, JoJo English was talking to him and he got baited into, as you said, this skirmish. And not only did we lose him for that game, but we lost him for the next game, which was a home game. And so, yeah, and then there were some other things around it that, you know, cameraman got tripped and, you know, it was like a wild scene. So,
yeah.
And no one wants to see that.
It's, right.
You know, to me, when it escalates to that, then you've gone over the line, obviously. But I think we're so worried about going over the line that we don't even let them approach the line anymore. And when teams approach the line, that's when you get their best basketball, when they're under control, but they're at their highest level of intensity. It's like a controlled frenzy, and that's when teams play their best.
And I think the 92-93 Knicks Bowl is a great example. My favorite series ever, the 84 Celtics-Lakers, that series took off with Mikal's clothesline. You watch that game 4, and once that happens, you know, later on Kareem's whistling an elbow at Bird's head and Bird's shoving Cooper out of bounds with his butt. And that, I mean, those teams went at it about as hard as you're going to go at it. None of it happens if the current rules are in place. Mikal gets thrown out. They start blowing whistles on everything. And I think we even, you know, Game 7 of the Celtics Bulls series, I just thought was just ruined by the refs because they were so scared of anything happening. Should there ever be 64 foul calls in a game?
Well, you know, you would hope not, because it does, you know, no one wants to see free throws. No one says, hey, you know what the beautiful part of that game was? Everybody made their free throws. You know, and I always hear old-timers lament the loss of fundamentals.
Yeah.
But free throw shooting is never one of the topics that people are talking about. You know, oh, they're 17 for 17. You know, coaches talk about free throw shooting because obviously it goes into big time into winning and losing. But as a fan's perspective, no one wants to see a free throw shooting contest.
No, and you know, for some of the teams that we have right now, it's not a great thing. Like the Celtics, for instance, used to be a much better free throw shooting team than they are. But back to the competitiveness part. LeBron, this guy is so physically overpowering at this point. Is it even possible to intimidate him or take him out of his game in any way?
I don't believe so. I think his mental strength and his mental toughness has improved every bit as much as his game has.
Yeah.
Last year, Game 7, I was shocked when he got beat to the loose ball on the jump ball in the last minute. And I think plays like that, because he has such a high basketball IQ, he knows the difference between winning a championship and losing could be one play in one game. And I think you watch him defend, he's a heck of a lot more consistent defender effort-wise than he's ever been. And I think a lot of that is losing last year to the Celtics, losing to the Spurs in the finals. You know, this growing process where he knows, hey, if I want to win it, I've got to play really hard, I've got to play very unselfishly, and I've got to get my team to play defense, because those are the things that it's going to take to win. And I'm very impressed by what he's done. The only thing to me that you can do is hope he's missing jump shots, because he's still not a consistent knockdown shooter. Improving, but not right there. So hopefully, if you're playing him, you give him a little bit more of a cushion, entice him into shooting some, you know, long two-point jump shots, you know, and then hope for the best.
I was watching last night's game with my dad. We were saying the same thing. Every time he shoots the three, if I'm the other team, I'm excited. Please, keep shooting those threes. We love when you do that.
Well,
then we're not fouling you.
Yeah, I would go one step further than that. We used to love when we were playing the Celtics, back in the Antoine Walker Pierce days, when Antoine Walker made his first three. It was like, thank you. Because it would always bring more threes. And we never had an answer for him on the block, but once he made that first three, it's like he didn't want to go to the block. And if he missed his first couple threes, then like almost reluctantly, he would go down there, you know, get to the basket, foul trouble, you know, all the things that go with when you get some penetration to the rim. So,
God, you're preaching in the choir. I mean, and you were a coach during the era when, really, one of the two most dangerous eras in NBA history, the other being the cocaine era. But from 93 to 99, guys just getting paid too much too soon. And somebody like Antoine, who really his career should have been a lot better than it was, because as you said, he had awesome footwork, he had great hands. He's somebody that if he was in shape and developed some moves, would have been a really tough matchup, I think, on the low post for just about anybody. And by his fourth year, he was a three-point shooter. And that's what he wanted to be. And nobody's going to talk him out of it because he's making $50 million a year. And I think you look at that era, and there's so many guys like that that you think, man, hey, even somebody like Chris Webber. Guy's probably one of the best 75 players ever in his career. I feel like was disappointing because he just had too much too soon. And you look at those guys, man, it's a long list. It's depressing.
That's an interesting point as far as too much too soon. I like the rookie salary wage. I think it's really helped. I think some of these second rounders, you actually feel better about the second rounders.
Yeah.
If you're a second rounder, I'd rather be picked 31st than 30th, because you know you have a chance to get to free agency earlier, and so if you deserve it, you know, more power to you. However, I just think it, you know, you're not facing holdouts in our league. There's no holding out. You know, it's not like baseball where you draft and then guy has the threat of going back into school, or NFL where you sit there and you wait it out and almost ruin your first year oftentimes. You know, the rookie wage scale, it was a brilliant stroke by David Stern and the players union, because it's really brought some sanity into the salary structure of the younger player.
What do you miss the most about coaching?
I miss, and these are my three C's, in no particular order, the competition, the camaraderie, and charter flights.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So those are the three things I miss. I mean, you cannot, in any other phase, in any other part of your life, find an outlet for professional sports played at the highest level by the best players, trying to get guys to play at a high level, game planning, the playoffs being a seven-game series. There's nothing like coming into a winning locker room with guys that you really respect and trust. And even there's nothing like coming into a losing locker room with guys you respect and trust.
Yeah.
And so all those things, you know, it can be, you know, some of these players, I don't think sometimes we appreciate what they really go through. Heck, they make a ton of money. They, you know, it's a great job. And yet you try to even run 4 miles, you know, after you, like, play for 2 hours, get on a plane, land, get into a place at, like, 3 a.m., try to get to sleep, you can't, and you're up the next day for a noon meeting, trying to catch a quick nap, and then regenerating enough energy to play well. I mean, it's just, it's hard to do, and you do it year after year.
Well, yeah. And then on top of that, you have, you know, you're also your own cottage industry. You have your agent, you have your wife or your girlfriend, you have your 40 family members who want you to help fund their barbershop or whatever's going on. You're dealing with that whole world too. And you're trying to stay in shape. You're trying to prepare for the other team, listen to coach. Wow. It's a lot going on. I agree with you. I think today's generations of stars have handled it, I think, as well as anybody we've seen in any professional league.
And you make a good point. And the one word that you have to learn as an NBA player and be willing to use it is no.
Mm-hmm.
Because unless you're willing to do that, and I had one player who was unwilling to do that, so I told him, listen, I know you're not going to say no, so tell him I said no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll be the bad guy. It's no problem. Whether it was another appearance or, you know, because what we don't understand is back when I first came in the NBA, there were no community events. Nothing. Nothing. Yeah. Zero. Our guys were just, hey, they went to practice, they went home. Maybe an occasional appearance here and there, but it was nothing like it is now. Now they're going out basically every off day at home. Someone's trying to get them to do something, whether it's, like you said, their agent or it's the team. There's a lot more entities grabbing at their time. And so to be able to prioritize and keep your game straight and keep yourself out of trouble, I think sometimes we focus on an athlete's 1% of, you know, whatever he makes mistake-wise versus, can you believe this 9% of the time?
Right. You know, to that same point, I think how LeBron has handled that is the single most amazing thing about his career so far. This guy is 24. He came from a broken home. He was famous at age 17. He plays near his house. He surrounds himself with all of his friends from high school, and somehow this has worked out. And I think his instincts have been impeccable. I mean, he hasn't been involved in one thing. You know, yeah, I haven't heard one bad LeBron story other than, you know, that maybe he wants to be a quadrillionaire or whatever, his global icon stuff, whatever's going on. But I just think you look at, like, compared to how Jordan's first 7 years went, it's no contest. He's been amazing.
No, I think it's right. And this is one of the reasons why when you make the argument that players are better suited to go to college, if they're stars, you'd have a hard time making that argument. You know, LeBron James is, like you said, a prime example of a guy whose maturity and ability, not just on the court, but off the court, to live right, stay out of, you know, trouble and trouble spots, really amazing. Because, you know, this guy, I'm sure, is being tempted with distraction after distraction. And to come through it as well as he has, as you said, the word is amazing.
If you had to pick one star to coach, not talent, personality, and character and the way they click with teammates, would he be the pick?
He wouldn't have been until this year. I would have gone with Bryant. And I know everybody tells me...
Wow!
Yeah, everybody tells me about, you know, him being hard on teammates. Listen, if you're playing with some of the softies that he's played with, you need, you know, a killer to drive the whip. And I'll take anybody who has passion and who has a relentless work ethic and work with them on how to speak to teammates. But I think it's really, really hard to teach a guy to have an incredible will and passion for the game. Because through the money, through playing for a long time, most guys lose it because they just don't like the game anymore. They just don't want that life. I am so impressed. Bryant, you're 13, still that insatiable hunger to be great and to win. And I think LeBron James saw it, wants the same thing, and wants to win big, and at the same time still be a global icon, which is fine with me.
Right.
But he's not putting basketball second, which a lot of guys do once they finally make it.
On the flip side, Tracy McGrady, where would you place him in that?
You know what? I think he's taken a lot of undeserved criticism. I think McGrady, and some of it is brought about by what he says. So he says some things that I know he wishes he could take back. But as far as when I coached him, he's not the same personality type as Bryant. You know, he's much more laid back, but incredibly high basketball IQ. Incredibly talented in big games. Like, if you look at his playoff numbers are so much better than his regular season numbers, which just doesn't happen. You know, I'm not sure McGrady would be your number one guy you'd want to have on a back-to-back against a 20-win team in February.
Yeah.
But McGrady showed up big in the playoffs. Now, he never got over that hump in winning a first-round series, but I would say that he was favored once, and if you really go compare his team to the other, his opponent in the playoffs, you would say, you would come back and say, man, I can't believe they got as close as they did. And yet, people want to bury him for what he isn't versus appreciating him for what he is. That being said, he has been hurt a lot, so durability is a big issue. Because if you can't come and do your job, how great can you be at your job? And I think, you know, those are legitimate questions, but those should also be asked about guys who, you know, other guys who've gone through injuries, like you said, Weber or Yao Ming or, you know, other guys. I think too often, you know, we focus in on McGrady and what he hasn't accomplished versus what he has accomplished.
I think McGrady is in that level between superstar and star where if he's your best guy, you're probably not winning the title. But if you put him with an alpha dog who doesn't even have to be your best guy, like say he played with Kevin Garnett, and Kevin Garnett could do all the emotional stuff that you need from one of
your best guys. He would have won a championship.
Yeah.
No question.
But if you're putting all that on T-Mac, he's not going to deliver. But
and,
I think
and
in that Pierce role.
And if you're going to put it all on Garnett,
he's not going to deliver either.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's very few guys that actually can deliver with very little help. And that's why, you know, to me, Bryant, you know, again, when you evaluate players, Bryant getting Pau Gasol and, you know, you can either focus on...
And Lamar.
Yeah, and Lamar. You can focus on their perceived weaknesses, which there are, or on their skill and talent. And if Bryant can drive the emotional whip, which he has, and that is one soft front line that they have in L.A. I mean, this is, to me, they're a championship contender because of Bryant's skill, the other talent they brought around him. But they wouldn't have a chance if Bryant didn't have that incredible will and passion to win, you know, elevating his teammates to care as much as he does, or at least pushing them toward that.
I've been saying for the last few weeks, dating back to like beginning of April, I don't think this Lakers team is very good. Like, I think if you look at like their supporting guys, those guys aren't playing nearly as well as they did last year, and really, I don't see much of a difference between this team and the 2006 team other than replacing Pau Gasol with Chris Mim. The guys 4 through 10 are not doing it. They just aren't.
Well, and I think everyone said they, and I was one, kept saying they were a deep team.
No.
And you're absolutely right. They've lost a lot of depth. Think of it. They traded away or let Turiaf go,
yeah,
who was also an emotional, energetic player.
And one of their best defensive, and they're one of their best defensive low post guys.
No doubt. And Radmanovic, who may have been a little spacey, but provided shooting. That was a financial move.
Spreaded the floor.
Right. Then they, you know, Farmar, due to injury, or maybe not, you know, not believing in the role that's been carved out for him, has had a lesser year. Vujicic, a much lesser year.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to him.
Right. Luke Walton, Ariza's back, but Luke Walton's playing on the bench. He's coming off injury right now, lesser year. And Bynum right now, I'm going to say, Bill, if I was the coach right now of the L.A. Lakers, I would be tempted to play Banga over Bynum.
Oh, my God. You just killed every Laker fan. They're convinced he's the next Bill Russell. Andrew Bynum.
No,
they're not rational about Bynum.
He may be, and he's 21, and he's had great moments.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, at this moment in time, he is not an efficient, productive guy coming off your bench. Maybe if Odom doesn't play, you know, in game five, and he gets a chance to start and get into a rhythm, maybe he'll find his way. That's why I thought Farmar would be better served starting and bringing Fisher off the bench.
Well, and Fisher is another guy that you didn't mention that has slipped noticeably, and I agree with you on Farmar. And I actually talked about this with my buddy Hassan on yesterday's podcast. Certain guys are just meant to start. And I think Farmar, if you watch what he did in game three, he looked like the old Farmar. So maybe he's meant to start. And maybe Bynum is the same thing. Maybe he just can't play 15 minutes a game. He just can't get warmed up. Or I'm sure you've coached guys that just, for whatever reason, just couldn't play a reduced role.
Right. And also, it's when they're asked to play a reduced role. When you're 21, 22, 23, which those kids are, you know, maybe mentally they're just, you know, they are not capable of being coming off injuries of being effective, you know, role players. And so the bottom line is, who are they counting on off their bench right now?
I don't know.
Who can they count on to do one thing well every night off their bench? And I would say the answer is they can't count on anybody except Shannon Brown, to me, has been their most consistent bench player. And if he's been their most consistent bench player, that's not a deep team.
Yeah, and I think you look at how easy the Lakers would be to beat by the right type of team. And the Ariza and Fisher, those guys just not hitting threes consistently. A guy like Aaron Brooks just kills. Those little water bug point guards, they have no answer for. They can't stop. And then on the front line, I just don't think they're very tough. I think they could be pushed around by the right type of team, which leads me to my next question. Denver, could they potentially beat this Lakers team?
Well, before you jump...
Oh, you're going to play the Houston card on me.
I am.
All right.
You know, I thought before the series that Houston would either win in six or lose in seven. Now, people would say, well, yeah, L.A.'s going to respond. It was just, you know, a bad game. And they could easily be right. Except for this. You just made the point that they have trouble with quick guards. And their biggest liability is pick and roll defense and covering to the three-point line. They give up a lot of three-point attempts.
Yep.
Well, when you're playing, you know, Russian roulette with a team that has those strengths, like Houston does, and then they have the ultimate wild card in our test, who's to say that, you know, Houston doesn't, hey, if they get a miracle tonight and win, who's to say they couldn't win a sixth game at home? I mean, I think the whole toughness, physical and mental toughness on the Laker team emanates from their backcourt. I think Fisher has it. I think Bryan has it. I think Farmar has it. I think Vujicic has it. And I think Shannon Brown has it. But I don't see it in their front court. And Scola, Landry, Chuck Hayes, they might not wow you with talent, but they do wow you with toughness. And if there's a 50-50 ball to have the game won tonight, and it involves any front court player of the Lakers or a front court player of the Rockets, who are you betting is going to get it?
Yeah, it's a great point. I would also throw in, this is something that Darryl has mentioned to me, and I'm sure he's mentioned to you too. It's a team that, from a character standpoint, is kind of built to play on the road. Like somebody like Scola, he's played in games in Europe that so far surpass anything from a scary level of playing in the Staples Center? I mean, give me a break. These guys aren't going to be intimidated by the Lakers crowd. And I also think that Lakers crowd, you can kind of cut their heart out early. They'll get quiet if they fall behind by eight. And I just don't think it's that big of a task to win a game there. Here's my question, though. Aaron Brooks, second-year point guard. We saw it with Parker in 2003. We saw it with Rondo last year. The second-year point guards, they show up or they don't. You just don't know. Does he have two out of three games in him?
Well, the question would be, yeah, can he put back-to-back games together?
Or even 5 and 7, something like that. Or five and – yeah, I don't know. He just needs two.
He needs – you know, you would bet on the at home that he'll have big games, you know. So game six, I wouldn't be shocked. But he's got to come up with a road game. It doesn't have to be a 30-point game, but it has to be, I'm living in the paint, and I'm going to keep attacking so that the defense gets compacted. We've got three-point shots. We can now get second shots, as we've seen the Rockets do, because of dribble penetration. Mm. And their guards have to live in the lane. And that's why, you know, our test, again, to me, he's a very good three-point shooter who had a very bad game in Game 4. But he's got to drive that ball. If he drives it, you know, his physical prowess is so hard to deal with. And then if he can make some good plays off the dribble, which he did in Game 4, again, hey, you don't know if you're going to make those three-point shots, but I have no doubts that the Rockets are going to have good open threes, and now it becomes a make-or-miss league. And you know what? You brought up Daryl's name, Bill, and I want to just throw this out there. Everybody's talking about free agents in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know Daryl's contractual situation, but I'd put his name at the top of the list.
Wow.
Because you look at what he's done with that roster.
It's amazing.
He has done, you know, has he missed on C. Francis? Yeah, but look at all the makes he's got. Steve Novak, Shane Battier, Ron Artest, Scola, Landry, Chuck Hayes. I mean,
Aaron Brooks.
I mean, it's just, you know, Kyle Lowry. I mean, to me, he has done a fantastic job, and this is from a guy who he fired. So, I mean, you know, this is not like, you know, some friend of his just blowing smoke. I mean,
yeah,
you know, so I couldn't be more impressed. And this is why I think general managers are underrated, because everybody says this is a players' league. It's not as much a players' league as it is who picks the players' league. You've got to have the right person picking your players.
Well, and you look at like what he did compared to what San Antonio did. Basically, they had the same late end of the round draft picks and free agent bargains and these small time deals, and Daryl was able to pull it off. And San Antonio could just never, you know, finally they had a nice run, but finally they just couldn't figure out how to get those fifth through tenth guys, and it finally came back to bite them this year. It's the single hardest thing to do as a GM. Who do you go? Who are these smaller time guys that you can go after that end up making your team? Aaron Brooks, I think he was 28th pick.
He was down there like 26 to 28, somewhere in there, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. So give me your finals pick at gunpoint.
I'm going to take the Lakers and Cleveland. You know, I think Cleveland.
That's boring.
Yeah. Cleveland is going to beat Boston, I think, easily in the conference finals.
Are they 12-0 going into the finals?
No. Boston has too much pride for that. You know, I think actually Orlando would give Cleveland a tougher time than Boston will. I just can't see Orlando beating Boston in a series.
I can't either. Not with games 5 and 7 at home. I think what happened in game 4, the crowd is just going to be at another level tonight. Every time I say this, by the way, I jinx the team, so I should probably recant it, but hey, at this point, the fans are just so proud of this team. You know, I just think they're going to show up.
And you know what? I think the Eastern Conference, you know, the top three teams in the East, yeah. I'm not so sure against the Lakers I wouldn't take. I would still take the Celtics. If the Celtics got over to the Lakers in the finals, even without Garnett, I'm taking the Celtics.
Yeah. So you think Cavs over Lakers?
I do now. Before, a month ago, 2 months ago, I would have said no. But right now, I'm not going to make the same mistake I did last year. I picked the Lakers, and I discounted the Celtics' defense, and I'm not doing that anymore. I'm going to I'm going to go with the team that wants to compete. They've got star power. They've got shooting. And that's one thing
defense.
I think the Lakers, you know, everybody's talking about intensity. One thing that they have not surrounded Kobe with, like Cleveland surrounded LeBron with, is shooting. You know, the shooting is much different. The ability to spread the floor with their smalls and their bigs. You know, Joe Smith and Ilgauskas can all make the perimeter shot, which gives James more room. Hey, Bryant, when he's playing with Ariza and Odom and Gasol, and right now, you know, struggling guards who aren't knocking it in, there's really not very much room for him to get into the paint and get to the basket.
I think this Lakers team can be beaten. And really, ironically, it will come down to Game 5. Because if Houston can somehow win Game 5, I don't think the Lakers can beat them two in a row. So as weird as this sounds, I feel like tonight is a Game 7. So,
and do you think Denver would beat them if they get?
No, you know, Denver, it's the old Steve Kerr knucklehead theory. Too many knuckleheads. I just feel like they're going to lose their composure at the wrong time. And I know Billups is a great leader and all that stuff, but even you saw it last night. If Carmelo connects with that little swipe, he gets suspended for the next game. It's almost like you're playing with Russian roulette with that team. You know what I mean? Too many guys who can screw it up in too many different ways. And then on top of it, George Karl, I just think, has a history of when the ship starts sinking, he has had a bad history of plugging the holes. I know you can't criticize another coach, but I'm just a little worried about things are going right. They look great. But when things are going wrong, what happens with that team? I don't know.
You have to come up with a nickname for their bench, though. Those three guys.
It's the best.
Anthony Carter, out of the league for a while, somehow works his way back in and is impacting games.
Yeah.
Chris Anderson and J.R. Smith, to me right now, as effective and impactful as any bench in the league, they need a nickname. I don't know what it is, but they need one.
Maybe something with ink or tats. Ink attack. J.R. Smith, not a lot of teams have a guy who can come off the bench and scored like 20 points in a quarter. It's kind of a luxury at this point.
So you think about, you know, thinking back on your sixth man of the year vote, which I think is preposterous anyway, that whole award. But, like, if you are having one, you know, Jason Terry, outstanding year. J.R. Smith, as impactful as anybody coming off the bench.
Yeah, and I think, you know, nobody's mentioned this, but the Boston Celtics, that $1.5 million slot they had last summer, they gave to Patrick O'Brien over Chris Anderson. I think they just maybe decided he wasn't worth the risk, or they weren't totally sold he'd come back. But, man, you put him on the Celtics team, and I think it's a much easier Orlando series, obviously. Last question. Are you going to come back to coaching, or are you going to continue to be part of the best three-man basketball booth, in my opinion, of all time?
Well, first of all, I appreciate you saying that. That's
You're
very
welcome.
Nice.
Well, it's true.
You know, I have a long-term contract with ESPN.
Nice.
And I like it. But that being said, I definitely want to coach again. Now, I may well have to go back to being an assistant coach first.
Oh, stop it.
No.
Come on.
You lose two first-round series being up 2-0.
Please.
No, I'm being serious. You might have to start back at ground zero and work your way back up, which I have no problem doing.
No way.
The point is, I do miss those, you know, that competition and that camaraderie. Broadcasting is a great lifestyle. I really enjoy the guys I work with and work for, yet nothing replaces the highs and lows that you feel when you're with guys that you really respect. And I've been blessed. You know, it's all about who your best players are in the NBA.
Yeah.
If you got the right ones, you got a chance. If you got the wrong ones, you have no chance. And, you know, when you have guys like Ewing and Oakley and Larry Johnson and Sprewell in Houston, and then back in Houston having Yao, and, you know, I like McGrady a lot more than a lot of people do, and you have, like, a lot of tough guys around him, it's a great job. If you have the wrong guys, man, I don't think there could be a worse, more miserable job than being an NBA head coach with a group of knuckleheads.
Greatest example, I think, ever, and I just realized it this weekend reading the stories about the late Chuck Daly. Here's a guy who coaches a coach's dream of a team, the Bad Boy Pistons, who were basically run by Isaiah and Lambeer, doing a lot of his dirty work, and nobody's going to not, you know, stand up to those guys or not follow their orders. goes to New Jersey, deals with the Derek Coleman, Kenny Anderson combo. And then I totally forgot about this, went to Orlando in 97, had to coach Penny Hardaway.
And if you remember, Penny Hardaway was like a no-show in that Philadelphia series.
No-show, yes.
And, you know, like, was just, you know, a total attitude, you know. I mean, Chuck Daly spoke about that all the time, about just, you know, that year being very, very challenging and difficult.
He walked away. He walked away from $5 million because he'd never wanted to see Penny Hardaway again. But I think, you know, it goes back to what we were talking earlier about the too much, too soon era. Daly was fortunate enough to come up during the era when that wasn't the case, and then his career crested during that era. And the fact that he couldn't reach Penny Hardaway tells you that it's not easy to coach an NBA team. One of the reasons we have a lot of turnover. Anyway, I really hope that you never coach again because I love hearing you on TV.
Well, thank
so
you.
Here's one vote. Here's one vote for you to stay on ESPN ABC forever.
I'll have you call my bosses on that.
Can't you coach like a junior high school team in your spare time? Get it out there.
There you go.
Yeah.
You know, Larry Brown always said he'd go back to coaching high school. I coached high school, and I will say this: it was my single most enjoyable year I've ever coached. Mm. McQuaid Jesuit High School, Rochester, New York, $1,500. The most enjoyable, but it couldn't pay the bills.
And I bet the players listened to you.
Oh, yeah, great guys. They probably shouldn't have listened to me because at that time, being my first year in coaching, I thought I knew all the answers. And
yeah.
About halfway through the year, I realized I didn't even know what the questions were. So, you know.
Right. Well, I think you can still get some of that camaraderie and chemistry that you miss so much just by playing backgammon with Mike Breen. I think it'll be fine.
You obviously don't know Mike Breen if you think there can be any camaraderie.
I know.
He's the most high-maintenance guy in the whole wide world. So.
Prima donna. It's unbelievable.
There you go.
All right, Jeff Van Gundy, thank you so much for your time. Love to have you on the BS Report. And we will hear you Thursday night. Which game are you doing?
Houston Lakers, Game 6.
Houston Lakers. Beautiful. Thanks again.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Target the center. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
You laughed, you cried, you turned up the sound repeatedly, and now it's all over. This concludes another installment of the BS Report. And with all the talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important just-breaking news.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin.
The $5 foot-long anthem rolls on with Subway Everyday Value. So many of your Subway favorites are $5 foot-longs, like that Tastetacular Spicy Italian $5 foot-long and the piled ridiculously high BLT $5 foot-long, both made to your order on the freshly baked bread of your choice.